Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Emily, and I'll be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $300,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. Now I'd like to introduce Professor James Gosling, the chair of the Political Science Department. Thanks.
Welcome to the University of Utah and the Department of Political Science. To those of you who are here from out of town, I want to apologize, first for the weather, and secondly for the views. Now, Perry gave me a job, and the job she assigned to me today is to introduce Betty Glad to you, whose financial generosity makes this symposium possible. Betty Glad graduated magna cum laude from the University of Utah in political science and went on to earn a PhD in international relations from the University of Chicago. She was an expert on the American presidency and U.S. foreign policy and was the author of many scholarly articles and books, including her 2009 book, An Outsider in the White House, Jimmy Carter, His Advisors, and the Making of American Foreign Policy. It was published by Cornell University Press in 2010. Dr. Glad received many awards for her work, including the Harold Laswell Award of the International Society for Political Psychology for a lifetime of outstanding contributions in that subfield. The American Political Science Association honored her with the prestigious Frank Goodnow Award for her many contributions over a long period of time to political science. Following her death in 2010, and according to her wishes, her estate bequeathed a generous gift to the University of Utah's Department of Political Science to support departmental research and scholarly activity by both faculty members and graduate students and faculty members working in concert with graduate students, and to make symposia like this one possible. So I'm going to turn to Professor Perry Schwartz-Shea for her introduction of our keynote speaker, and I have to excuse myself shortly thereafter in order to teach, of all things. So, Perry.
Thank you, Jim, and welcome to the audience. I'm so glad to see you here all today. Professor Zachary Schrag earned a PhD at Columbia University, and he is currently professor of Department of History and Art History at George Mason University. We were very pleased that Zachary Schrag agreed to give this keynote because he has written the seminal book that outlines the ways in which the Institutional Review Board policy that was initially designed to protect people who participate in biomedical experiments, how that policy came to be extended across the social sciences and even into the humanities. So his 2010 book is entitled Ethical Imperialism, Institutional Review Boards and the Social Sciences, 1965 through 2009, and that is John Hopkins University Press. Dr. Schrag has also won a number of awards. The Journal of Policy gave him the Ellis Halley Prize. The Library of Congress gave him a Klug Fellowship. He had a National Science Foundation dissertation grant in 2001. And probably most important, Zachary Schrag has really been tireless in helping to inform the social science community in his blog about the ways in which this very complex federal policy works, the debates, the various interpretations. And it is a difficult policy to understand, a significant policy, and he will be talking today, as you can see, political science, academic freedom, and institutional review boards in historical perspective. And the first part of that phrase, political science, or excuse me, I missed the top part, the freedoms we are committed to protect. That phrase is a phrase from Ithiel de Sola Poole, who is a political scientist at MIT, founder of the MIT Political Science Department, who was initially quite concerned about the extension of this policy to the social sciences and played a key role in the early days of the development of that policy. And so, with no further ado, Dr. Zachary Schrag.
Hold on, I think someone has part of my talk. It was all up here.
He did.
I grabbed it.
Sorry about that. Took the words right out of my mouth. Okay. I'm very honored to be speaking here today, and thank you for that kind introduction. Very glad to be part of a symposium on so important a topic. I've been known as something of a critic of IRBs, so I thought I'd say something nice about them to start with, and that is that it's interesting. It's interesting to study the current system of regulating human subjects research. For those who have never gone through an IRB process, never dealt with an IRB, the subject can seem obscure and perhaps even trivial. But human subjects research regulation lies at the intersection of knowledge and power and money and freedom. And therefore, it does raise some very interesting questions. And what makes this a particularly fun topic for me is how it brings together people from so many different disciplines. Partly this is because the IRB is a matter of common concern, some would say a common enemy. So you get collaboration among anthropologists, sociologists, geographers, folklorists, linguists, communication scholars, and as of this moment, a historian speaking to political scientists. And thank you for letting me crash. Yet even as these scholars come together in their concerns about the IRB, they bring together distinct assumptions and tools that shape their responses to regulatory structures and process. So as a historian, for example, I've always been interested in the efforts to restrict oral history interviews. That's how I first got interested in this. And I've also used interviewing and good old-fashioned archival research to do histories of the IRB, most notably in the book that you heard about. Sociologists, by contrast, tend to write about the sociology of IRBs. Ethnographers sit in on IRB meetings. Legal scholars look at the legal claims to legitimacy that these institutional review boards have. And political scientists have joined this effort as well, though I will say quite frankly that I wish they had done more, especially in recent years. Human subjects regulation is nothing if not an exercise in power. And all scholars from various social science fields desperately need the insights that political scientists can bring to this subject. The relatively small role played by political scientists in recent years is quite a contrast to the late 1970s and early 1980s, critical years in the history of the IRB regime when today's regulations were essentially formed. And at that point, one of the most prominent critics of unfettered regulation was, as you've heard, a political scientist, Ithiel de Sola Poole. Poole was a founding member of the MIT Political Science Department, and later became the Ruth and Arthur Sloan Professor of Political Science. And he was interested in all kinds of stuff, from elections to the Vietnam War. He's probably best remembered today for his work on electronic communications, whose significance and prescience really I think we can all appreciate. I mean, this is someone who was writing about the possible effects of the Internet essentially as it was being first invented. For our purposes today, however, what matters about Poole is that he devoted considerable effort to combating what he saw as a dangerous intrusion by government into scholarly pursuits in the name of human subjects' protections. Poole was wrong about many things. He thought that South Vietnam would last a lot longer than it actually did, for example. But I think his analysis of the IRB problem remains quite astute. And here's how he framed it. Writing to a colleague in 1975, "There is no disagreement with the view that MIT should do its part in protecting subjects of research from unjustified harm. There is, I also trust, no disagreement that MIT should protect inviolate the traditions of free speech and academic freedom in our society. The problem that faces us is that some of the most convenient and efficient ways of protecting human subjects would violate the freedoms we are committed to protect." Now, maybe that sounds obvious. In the dozen years or so since the 9/11 attacks, we've all heard constant debates about the trade-offs, real or imagined, between security and liberty. And one might hope that everyone involved in the IRB debate would at least acknowledge that such trade-offs exist here between liberty and avoiding harm. Yet 30 years after Poole's death, his claim remains disputed. As one leading manual in IRB operations puts it, and is repeated by IRB offices across the country, human subjects research is a privilege and not a right, such as the right of intellectual inquiry embodied in academic freedom. So this raises some interesting questions. What is a privilege? What is a right? What is intellectual inquiry? What is freedom? And crucially, who is best equipped to answer those questions? I don't think that any one component of the university has all the answers. Not the IRB, not the Faculty Senate, not even the History Department. I do believe that political science faculty are uniquely equipped to provide some of the answers, as well as guidance on how policy might change. So what I thought I'd do is take this opportunity to pose some questions that I've long wished to pose to political scientists and give you all some homework to do. So I've got four main questions, the first of which is, what is research? One of the central questions in this whole matter is what kinds of activities merit the unusual, even extraordinary scrutiny of an ethics board. In other words, what is human subjects research? How should that term be defined and understood? IRBs were initially conceived in the 1960s to address a very specific type of research, medical experiments in human beings performed with federal funds. The National Institutes of Health and Clinical Center began a review process in 1953, and in the mid-1960s, the Public Health Service extended this to external grants. And if you want to look at the archetypal project that people were thinking about in the mid-1960s, you can look at the 1963 studies at the Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital in Brooklyn. Using federal funds, doctors Chester Southam and Emmanuel Mundell injected cancer cells into elderly patients to see how quickly they would be rejected. They did not seek the consent of these patients or even tell them that their bodies were being used as part of an experiment. And based on this and other cases, many of which became quite controversial, the National Institutes of Health concluded that it could not rely on investigators' consciences to prevent unethical research. Instead, it would require researchers to run their plans by an ethics body, which we now know as the IRB. But experimentation of this sort is only one form of research, and almost from the very beginning, scholars and policymakers struggled to figure out the appropriate scope of regulation. For example, the notorious Tuskegee syphilis study, which more than any other study prompted the federal legislation that created today's regulations, was not an experiment. It was an observational study, and despite many misconceptions, it did not involve the injection of dangerous materials into people's bodies. There were other syphilis studies that did that, but that's another story. For our purposes, the big questions about the scope of human subjects research come to the methods used by social scientists: talking and reading. And there's a third question that we heard about a little bit before today, which is looking, where people actually go in and do participant observation. And while many scholarly disciplines have concerns about how these activities are regulated, I think political scientists have specific practices that need to become a greater part of the debate over IRB rules. Talking, for example, interviews and surveys, political scientists are somewhat unusual in the frequency with which they talk to people in power. This was not the kind of interviews that the regulators were thinking about back in the 1970s when they wrote today's rules. Rather, they were talking about talking to relatively powerless, vulnerable people who might reveal sensitive information. And the archetypal study here was Laud Humphrey's research on anonymous sex between men, eventually published in 1970 as the book Tea Room Trade. Humphrey's managed to avoid outing any closeted men, but had he done so, the results would have been disastrous for their careers, marriages, and possibly even personal freedom. And though he was only a graduate student at the time of the research, one could make the argument that he had considerably more power than the men he studied, in large part because he deceived them by disguising himself and pretending to be working on a separate health survey. And this remains the interview imagined by both regulations and local IRBs, an educated, powerful researcher, and a subject made vulnerable first by the inability to control the interaction, in this case because of deception, and secondly, because of the negative consequences of any breach in confidentiality. And certainly sometimes political scientists engage in that sort of interview today. But many who write about their IRB troubles are interviewing people with as much or more power than themselves. As Anthony Langlois, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, an Australian political scientist, explains, a research participant may be a voter, an ordinary private person, but they may also be an electoral representative, a minister of the crown, a judge, a public broadcaster, a private broadcaster with much political influence, a chief executive officer of a company which employs a major percentage of the population, a terrorist, an enemy combatant, an economic advisor, a novelist, a vice chancellor. The list could go on interminably. For each of these, the relationship which the person has to society is different, not just in degree, but in kind, to the relationship which a medical patient or a therapist's client has to society. And I would go even further than that in arguing that the ordinary person can take on a different relationship with society when they engage in matters of public concern. Ithiel de Solapoole, for example, first grew hostile to the IRBs in the mid-1970s when the MIT IRB sought to limit a colleague's interview with anti-busing activists, of which there were many in Boston in 1974. As Poole put it, segregationist bigots who were breaking the law. And Poole believed that the university had no right to stand between a researcher and these people who were taking public action. As he put it later in 1981, there is no denying that we can all do harm by the questions we ask and the things we say. We can offend, we can embarrass, we can annoy, but these are precisely the harms that 200 years ago, the framers of the Constitution decided had better be suffered rather than controlled. To require prior approval before a social researcher engages in an interview is as patently unconstitutional as it would be to require of a reporter or of an ordinary citizen. To any student of constitutional history, that is clear. Now, U.S. regulations today make only the barest concession to this idea. They exempt from IRB review interviews with elected or appointed public officials or candidates for public office. So there's this one category of powerful people that you can interview without getting anyone's permission, but as you heard from Langlois, that's just a very small category given the number of powerful actors we could imagine. Now, in 2011, the American Political Science Association endorsed a document called the Social and Behavioral Science White Paper that, among other things, advocates that this exception be broadened to exempt from IRB review interviews with any person who has public figure status. And the term public figure has specific meaning in U.S. defamation law, and we could probably use some elaboration on the degree to which that meaning can be transferred from defamation law to human subjects regulation. But I think it's on the right track. As Poole, I think, would say, you're interviewing activists about their activism, they are public figures, even if a similar interview about their private life would not be. And lest this sound crazy and radical, Canada knows this. In 2010, Canada revised its Tri-Council policy statement to acknowledge that some research involving critical assessments of public, political, or corporate institutions and associated public figures, for example, may be legitimately critical and or opposed to the welfare of those individuals in a position of power and may cause them some harm. And Poole, I think, would have loved this, except for the fact that it's the rule in Canada and not the United States. We had a revolution for this, right? And subjects of the crown have more liberty than we do in political speech. That upsets me. I think it would have upset Poole as well. Now, none of this is to dismiss the dangers that interviewing can pose to people who talk to researchers or the researchers' consequent responsibilities. In 2011, as you probably know, the United States Attorney's Office filed a subpoena for two tapes that were recorded as part of Boston College's oral history archive on the Troubles in Northern Ireland. The U.S. Issued the subpoena at the request of the Police Service of Northern Ireland, part of the British government, and British authorities seem to want these tapes for an investigation into murders and kidnappings committed decades ago. 3 years after the subpoenas were issued, interviewers and various folks at Boston College are still pointing fingers at each other about who was responsible for promises of confidentiality that the college later felt unable to uphold when confronted by a court order. And scholars and archivists are worried about the chilling effects that the case will have on other potential interview projects. To argue, as I do, that IRB oversight would not have helped and could actually have aggravated the problem is not to deny that the problem exists. So talking is a problem, but it may not fit into the IRB model. The same is true when it comes to reading. When IRBs get involved in trying to control what they call data, what others of us call words, funny things can happen, and I think the most absurd version of this came out of UCLA a few years ago, where they say, if you've got a data set, make sure you have permission, and one of the examples they had of a possibly public data set would be letters to the editor or blogs. So literally at UCLA, if you want to read the letters to the editor column from your local newspaper, you're supposed to get permission first to make sure that the university administration believes that this is public data. But the fact is that there are some serious concerns, however inept the UCLA administration might be. And researchers do try to protect the privacy of those they study through the management of data. And we've recognized this for decades. For example, back in 1977, a federal commission recommended statutory protections that would have blocked the Boston College subpoena and other subpoenas for recorded data. That's been ignored. I don't think anyone's made a better recommendation in the last 40 years, but there's not been any congressional action, and the task gets more complicated every day. For example, in January of this year, the National Research Council produced a report that recommended that regulations should not control access to information as long as individuals whose information is obtained have no reasonable expectation of privacy. And then they talk about new forms of large-scale data that would not be considered human subjects research if all the information is publicly available to anyone, including for purchase. That is, if Facebook is selling your posts, well, anyone can buy them. If persons providing or producing the information have no reasonable belief that their private behaviors or interactions are revealed by the data, and if investigators are using the data have no interaction or intervention with individuals, investigators must observe the ethical standards for handling such information that guide research in their fields and the particular research context. Now, I think this is actually a sound recommendation. And I don't think university researchers should be prevented from reading material that's available to their next-door neighbors. But these phrases, a reasonable expectation of privacy, a reasonable belief about private behaviors or interaction, in a shifting world of Facebook policies that change every day and National Security Agency revelations that come out hourly, how are we to know what is a reasonable expectation of privacy, and how are the scholarly disciplines supposed to keep their ethical standards up to date? So these are substantive questions. What kinds of research should scholars pursue and not pursue? So I think we need some answers from you folks. We also need to consider that freedom is as much about process as about substance. And IRB critics have long complained that IRBs infringe on their rights as scholars, and that's a phrase that Poole used. So this leads to my second question for you folks. What is a right? Again, you'll hear this from many an IRB office. Human subjects research is a privilege, not a right. If they are talking about sticking a needle in someone's arm, I'm willing to go with that. Right? As citizens, we generally do not jab needles into other people's arms. You have to pretend to be a nurse to do that. I've never asked for ID. I just trust in that uniform. But anyway, and many civilized countries, particularly in continental Europe, make this distinction. They impose ethics review for medical research, but not for social research. For now, however, the United States and other Anglophone countries tend to define human subjects research broadly enough to include talking among adults. And that, as Poole said, threatens the constitutionally protected right of anyone to speak, ask questions, read, write, observe, and communicate. So we must ask, is talking a right? And if there is a right to research, what processes are needed to protect that right? I assume you can read this in the back there. This is Eleanor Roosevelt holding up the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And just in case, I'll make it a little bigger. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. I think that means you get to talk to people and ask questions. And a great many universities assure their affiliates of some level of freedom in their work. And if yours doesn't, you might want to get on some drafting committee for a mission statement. So I think there are actually some claims that talking is a right. And there might even be some case law. There's really not so much case law on this. Probably the most relevant is Holocaust versus University of Minnesota, a federal case from about 20 years ago, I think. And this is a case in which a professor sued his university for forbidding him to continue a drug trial. Now, he lost, but only after a federal court went through a four-part test to see if he had been afforded due process. They found that he had been given clear and actual notice of the charges against him, notice of the names of those bringing the charges and the specific nature and basis of the charges, a reasonable time and opportunity to respond, and a hearing before an impartial board or tribunal. If research were merely a privilege, the court would not have gone through this test. To the contrary, it cited a precedent that in turn states that public employees may have a property right in continued employment. So we have some basis to believe that researchers do in fact enjoy rights. What rights? Well, first of all, protection when they apply for IRB approval. As it stands, IRBs operate independently from one another with no requirement that they share their findings about what constitutes unacceptably risky research. Give a dozen IRBs an identical proposal and you may well get a dozen answers about what modifications, if any, would be required for the research to proceed. And this is not a hypothetical claim. Sociologist Laura Stark in her work actually gave an identical proposal to 18 IRB chairs. And the imagined proposal was that researchers would send men, some black and some white, to apply for the same job to see if employers were discriminating on the basis of race. And the reactions were all over the place, with one chair offering instant approval and others seeing the proposal as extremely problematic. This does not bother Stark. She thinks it's fine if one university rejects the research and the one across the street accepts it. But federal regulators have identified such inconsistency as a major concern, and I would argue that researchers deserve better than this kind of arbitrary decision-making. Similarly, I would argue that researchers deserve protection against arbitrary sanctions, such as the suspension or termination of their research, or in more serious cases, the termination of employment or the denial of a degree. In a recent case at the University of Colorado Boulder, about which I'll say a little more later on, the university administration seems to have violated its own procedures for investigating concerns about sexual harassment, procedures designed to protect the innocent. Universities may need comparable procedures as they investigate possible misconduct in human subjects research. The most debated right, procedural right, would be the right to appeal. In the University of Minnesota case, the court found that the right to appeal is not a necessary part of procedural due process, but it could be a valuable reform, giving researchers added hope of being treated fairly. And beyond due process, the right to appeal can build shared knowledge. Again, the failure of IRBs to share their findings about what is acceptable and what is not is one of the most pernicious flaws of the present system and one of the oldest. Right back in sort of the founding period of IRBs, Yale law professor Jay Katz, a leading expert on human experimentation, told Congress of the current uninformed and secretive climate which pervades research decision-making. At present, decision-making remains divorced from pertinent prior decisions about of other committees or from scholarly and public evaluation and criticism. And he insisted that the only way to fix this was to have important decisions published so that people around the country and around the world could discuss them. The result, he predicted, would not only be better thought out decisions, but a more complex system of controls, which in effect would take into account much broader sources of information as to societal values. I regard the development analogous to the experience of the common law as the best hope for ultimately providing workable standards for the regulation of human subjects process. Congress ignored the recommendation and failed to impose any requirement that IRBs publish their decisions. And since the decisions cannot be appealed, no national body must reconcile the local precedents spun off by individual committees the way that appellate courts reconcile the work of district courts and the Supreme Court tries to deal with circuit splits. So the climate remains every bit as uninformed and secretive as it was in 1973. Now, Katz was a law professor. Perhaps it's unsurprising that he thought of the common law as his model. Since his work, some astute observers have suggested an alternative model for human subjects regulation, and that would be transportation safety. And there's a big difference here. The common law is based on an adversarial process and the meting out of penalties. The transportation sector relies on less punitive procedures. In the 1970s, for example, the Federal Aviation Administration created a non-punitive reporting system for pilots that remains in place today. And as researchers Tor Krogstad and Brian Edwards recount, by 1989, the system had received over 110,000 reports and had generated more than 1,000 alert bulletins and over 1,500 special studies. It has resulted in safer working practices because of robust and multiple forms of communication to frontline staff with the results from detailed analysis of error reports. And they're actually looking at drug research, and they say, the authors are not aware of any systematic approach to reporting compliance errors in the pharmaceutical sector, so it is little wonder that there's no systematic learning from mistakes. And I would just say, this is aviation, similar things in terms of ground transportation. The National Transportation Safety Board puts out these reports. Anyone can read them, but you can't use them in a lawsuit. It's a non-punitive reporting system. Now, interestingly, when you talk to some IRB defenders, they'll also talk about transportation safety, but quite differently. Just as I was getting interested in IRBs close to a decade ago now, a rather expensive IRB consultant told me that it made sense to impose rules even if no harm had yet taken place. As he's put it, you don't wait for an accident to put up a stop sign. Actually, this isn't true. This is a sign not too far from my house. This is, I've never met this person, but a blogger who lives near me. She was riding her bike, was hit by a turning car, and the transportation department came in and said, yeah, there really should be a no turn on red sign there. And there she is with the sign that was put up as a result of empirical evidence. So whether or not you have a punitive system like the common law or a non-punitive system like aviation safety, the important thing is when something goes wrong, you've got to tell people, and then you base rules on that, not guessing as the IRBs that Laura Stark talked to are so clearly doing. Okay, there's So there's more work to be done on this comparison between human subjects research and transportation regulation. I think political scientists would be really good at that. So I hope that this continues. On to question three. And since I'm channeling late eminent political scientists, I will borrow a line from Robert Dahl, who so recently died at the age of 98. His question, of course, was who governs? And he posed that question about the city of New Haven, but Ithiel de Sola Poole was asking the same question about the university. When Poole wrote of the freedoms, plural, we are committed to protect, he was speaking specifically of two freedoms. First of all, freedom of speech, which we all know about, and secondly, academic freedom as embodied in faculty governance. As he put it in the same memo, unlike journalists, the faculty are not the employees of the institution. In the oft-quoted phrase of I.I. Robbie, we are the university. And Poole feared that faculty governance was endangered, not least of which by the IRB system, which threatened to oppose a layer of federal regulation between teacher and student, peer and peer, dean and professor. And subsequent events have shown that Poole was quite right to be afraid. IRB advocates have long claimed that IRBs are just another part of the university or scholarly system. As three scholars from the University of Windsor recently argued, REBs, such as the Canadian term, are IRBs, and academic associations and journals need to reorient researchers' approach to ethics review from that of an additional time-consuming step or hurdle to a form of academic peer review, similar to the other scholarly review processes that academics are familiar with and anticipate responding to through their careers. I would argue that IRB is quite unlike scholarly peer review. When a scholar submits a manuscript or a tenure dossier, she has a reasonable expectation that her work will be reviewed by scholars in her field with particular expertise in her area of research. IRBs are too small to include experts from all the fields whose work they review, and scholars in the social sciences and humanities routinely complain that their work is being reviewed by inexpert boards. Moreover, traditional peer review gives researchers a choice. If you don't submit anything to peer review, then yes, you'll probably not win promotion. But most of us have a choice about which journal or scholarly press will receive our manuscript and which will be our second choice or third choice if the first ones reject the proposal. Try to do with this with IRBs and you're suddenly IRB shopping, going for the easiest one, which is roundly condemned in the literature. So unlike peer-reviewed journals, IRBs are monopolies. Similarly, when you do get that peer review letter or tenure letter that really didn't get what you were doing, you can often ignore it. One of my greatest experiences as a graduate student was having an editor tell me, don't read that letter. Editors have this and scholars have this privilege. But IRBs have the power to decide whether a project goes forward or not, they therefore have a power that no journal or press maintains. And I would also argue that scholars also retain the privilege of publishing in non-peer-reviewed fora, such as my blog. So IRBs are not peer review. The other things IRBs are not particularly good at is faculty governance. One can see the impulse to say, well, they're faculty boards, why not join them, as Malcolm Feely has recommended. And Feely recommends serve on them, do all you possibly can to facilitate the research of your colleagues rather than act as a censor. And sometimes this works. I can give you examples. And if people want to do this, far be it from me to tell them otherwise. That said, this is not the nicest service obligation you can take on. Usually service obligations are more reciprocal. You have a piece peer-reviewed, you peer-review for the same journal. You go up for tenure, next year you're on the tenure committee reviewing others' work in your field. IRB service is less symmetrical. Typically at a university, there are dozens or hundreds of medical protocols for each ethnographic study that come before. So why would an anthropologist have to review all of those medical protocols just to review the odd ethnographic study that comes around? And even if it's a non-medical IRB, most of the proposals are going to be psych experiments. And why should an anthropologist have to review 100 psych experiments that he may know nothing about just so he'll be in place to take care of the one anthropology protocol that comes by that academic year? Now, a few universities, mine included, are experimenting with a different model. Rather than recruit faculty to serve on the IRB itself, they are establishing advisory boards to help set general policy. And these advisory boards are new and scarce enough that we really don't know much about what they can do and should do, but since they are an effort to redistribute power from the administration to the faculty, I think they deserve the attention of those who are interested in power. Now, let me give you two stories about how different IRB review can be from other forms of scholarly evaluation and university governance, and both of these are very recent cases. December 2013, the Dean of Colleges and Arts and Sciences at the University of Colorado at Boulder told Professor Patty Adler, an IRB critic, by the way, that a former teaching assistant had expressed concern that Adler's teaching methods might be making some people uncomfortable. According to Adler, the dean told her that she was at risk of being fired or losing her retirement benefits. And when asked about that case, a university spokesman wrote, "In all cases involving people in research or teaching, whether controversial or not, we want to insist on the best practices to ensure full regulatory compliance. In some cases, this could involve review from our Institutional Review Board, which is responsible for regulatory compliance involving human subjects." Now, many observers instantly pointed out that this was nonsense. IRB oversee research, not teaching, and the claim was quickly withdrawn by the university. But it serves as a reminder that when a university sees a troublemaker, one of the first tools it grabs for is the IRB. One cheerful result of the Patty Adler affair, as it's known, is that the Faculty Assembly chartered not one but two task forces to investigate events, showing that the spirit of faculty governance is alive and vigorous at that institution. Now, just around the same time, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill faced a researcher's charge that the university had admitted unqualified students to bulk up its sports teams. Stung, the university administration responded with a range of accusations, the first of which being that the researcher's analysis, and I've underlined it here, contradicted information she provided in her formal application to the federally regulated IRB. And this is the press release saying IRB review triggered by federal rules regarding the use of data. And what's interesting to me is that in both of these cases, the universities pointed to federal rules to justify, or we could say excuse, their behavior. So this is a Colorado case, regulatory compliance, regulatory compliance. And in the North Carolina case, Willingham, the researcher, contradicted what she told a federally regulated IRB, and you saw that again on the previous slide. And what I see here is university administrations distancing themselves from their responsibilities for their own actions. Don't blame us. We're just following federal regulations. Poole had exactly the same experience in the 1970s. He started by complaining about what the MIT IRB was doing. Quickly, they said, "We're just following federal regulations," and Poole became a critic more of the federal policy rather than the university policy. So we've got IRBs in this interworld between university and federal administration. And this brings me to questions about federal regulation. And my fourth question for you today, how are laws made? Poole, I'm sorry to report, was largely unsuccessful in his efforts to narrow the scope of federal regulations. He worked on it for a long time, and he did win several concessions, enough to issue this memo in January 1981, very sad in the aftermath. Victory or nearly so, he told his hundreds of correspondents. This is right after the 1981 regulations were issued. The regulations more or less in place today. And what he noticed was that the regulations were only going to apply to research directly funded by one government department, the Department of Health and Human Services, which wasn't funding that much political science anyway. So he figured, this really isn't going to affect us most of the time. But even as he wrote that memo, Poole recognized what he called the temptation for institutions to say they will apply to the same policies to research funded in other ways as to research funded by HHS. And he called on his colleagues to scrutinize university implementation of the new regulations. So if you think about his intellectual journey here, he starts with university rules on the MIT IRB. He goes up to the federal level and spends 3 years of his life fighting at the federal level. And then he says, now that we've got some better rules. Let's see how they're implemented on the university level. And I think whatever you're trying to do with the regulation of research to change it or merely understand it, you've got to pay attention to this interplay between local and national rulemaking. So this leads to several questions about the federal regulations as they now stand. First of all, how weird are they compared to other regulatory endeavors? A few years ago, law professor Scott Burris argued that the federal regulations, known as the Common Rule, were quite odd. The Common Rule, he argues, was not designed by people thinking about regulatory technique. The Common Rule reflected a dream of radical regulatory purification. This was to be a legal system without lawyers, a political system without politics. And he argued that it was therefore doomed to fail. The IRB, in spite of its roots in philosophical deliberation, is structurally required to act as an adjudicatory body. The same features that might, in the absence of authority, make the IRB a fruitful deliberative body, its diverse composition and informal decision-making style, are toxic to its capacities as an overseer of research. And there's simply something to this. Is this going to be a bunch of friendly professors sitting around and giving advice, or is this going to be a compliance body telling you what you must do? That said, a diverse composition and informal decision-making style describes a lot of things. It describes juries. It describes legislatures. It even describes courts. So are IRBs really that unusual in the problems they create, and if so, and why? This was from a few years ago. A very recent critique from last month came not from an outside scholar, but from a scholar who had gone into government, and that was David Wright, who a historian who had served as the director of the Office of Research Integrity, and at the end of February resigned that post with a blistering letter of resignation, decrying what he called a remarkably dysfunctional HHS, Health and Human Services, bureaucracy. And among his many observations, first of all, the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Health, which controls both the Office of Research Integrity and the Office of Human Research Protections, the federal IRB office, he called it secretive, autocratic, and unaccountable. Not words describing any IRB, I'm sure. Second, public bureaucracies quit being about serving the public and focus instead on perpetuating themselves. This is exactly my experience with the Office of Assistant Secretary of Health. And being a historian of science, Wright went on to cite Max Weber here, so good for him. And finally, and this is perhaps most intriguing, he says that within this Office of Assistant Secretary of Health, you've got a collection of important public health offices that have agendas significantly different from the regulatory roles of the Office of Research Integrity and the Office of Human Research Protections. So he's saying that the very location of the Federal Human Subjects Protections Office within the federal government, within that big organizational chart, is causing some of these problems. And there is so much to be explored here. Do the human subjects regulations problems stem from the naivete of their drafters, as Burris charges? Does it come from the organizational structure, as Wright believes, or the nature of bureaucracy itself, with people trying to perpetuate their budgets and their staffing levels? And what is the norm? What do we expect here? Do we expect a regulatory office to manifest the sloppy incompetence of an IRB or the careful professionalism of a National Transportation Safety Board panel? Is the common rule, as Burris claims, radical? I don't know. And I do know who I think would be best equipped to give us the answer, political scientists. You are the folks who can be comparing human subjects regulations to other forms of regulations. Another important role for you is to figure out the question of stakeholders. Sociologists Carol Heimer and Julie Petty recently noticed that the regulation of human subjects research is a growth industry. The number of IRBs, the number of associated staff, has steadily increased, and this creates an interest group. They write, IRB professionals are the group most likely to support regulation, partly because they believe it's needed. Clearly, however, the expansion of regulation also increases demand for the services of IRB professionals. The more rules they are, the more people needed to enforce those rules, and the better they are paid. And the national voice of this interest group is a nonprofit called Public Responsibility in Medicine and Research, abbreviated PRIM, ampersand R, and pronounced PRIMR. And Heimer and Primer briefly mention, Heimer and Petty briefly mention PRIMR as boasting expert knowledge, which they call an additional component of professional claims making. But they have not delved into its history and operations, and I don't think anyone has, except for the relatively self-celebratory and self-congratulatory accounts published by PRIMR and those close to it. Now, PRIMR is hardly unique. We have all kinds of organizations out there that mix member services and advocacy. The American Automobile Association, for example, will tow your car and also lobby Congress. The National Rifle Association teaches kids to shoot and, you may be surprised to learn, also lobbies Congress. And we have this within the university community. We had the recent debate over the American Studies Association boycott of Israeli universities telling us that these institutions have diverse and sometimes confusing roles. So what do we make of the IRB staff and the organization, PRIMR, that represents them? PRIMR seems to have some clout within the federal government. They get federal officials to speak at their conferences, and the Office of Human Research Protection, a federal body, distributes PRIMR-produced training materials to every IRB that registers with it. Is this a healthy public-private cooperation, or is it regulatory capture? What does it mean that an organization that has such close links to regulators is also advising those regulators to keep the rules restrictive, just as researchers are demanding greater ease? So I think there's a lot of work to be done there. Third area of research in regulation is international comparisons. How might those comparisons help us understand the United States regulations, and how might a change in the United States affect other countries? Now, over the past 15 years or so, historians of the United States have gradually become aware of the existence of other countries. It turns out that much like the United States, other countries have also had revolutions, civil wars, railroads, reform efforts, ethnic clashes, the whole works. And this is what's really surprising. At times, those countries have affected the United States through the transmission of people's goods and ideas across international frontiers. And we're trying to figure out how to teach this and learn it and break down some ideas of American exceptionalism. That said, when it comes to a lot of topics, IRBs included, America can seem pretty exceptional. So this whole IRB notion, the reliance on prior review of human subjects protocols, was invented in the United States, specifically in at the National Institutes of Health. And it then internationalized. So the Declaration of Helsinki, for example, comes out in 1964, no idea of prior review. It's only in 1975, once the U.S. rules are well established, that the Declaration of Helsinki incorporates this IRB concept. And in my book, I present IRB review of social sciences basically radiating out from the United States into other countries with relatively little feedback in the other direction. And this still pretty much remains the case. So, for example, the 2011 advance notice for proposed rulemaking barely mentions any developments in other countries or the extensive literature about ethics review abroad. And this strikes me as a real pity, since international comparisons may be the best way to understand the effects of specific regulatory requirements and to anticipate the consequences of any changes to regulations here. So just to give you two quick examples, some of my favorites. One, again, is Canada. These are not official regulations, but they are binding on universities. In Canada, these guidelines were not written exclusively by a health agency, as took place in the United States, but by a coalition of three agencies, one on health, one on natural sciences and engineering, and one, astonishingly enough, on the social sciences and humanities. So scholars in the social sciences and humanities in Canada have had a seat at the table never, never enjoyed by their counterparts in the United States. And Canada has been much more ready to revise its rules than American regulators, whose rules have basically been unchanged in over 30 years. And then if you want to go really crazy, you can look at a country like Finland, where they do have occasional review of project in the social sciences, but only if it meets one of six specific features, such as the intervention in the physical integrity of subjects or exposures to exceptionally strong stimuli. So rather than seeking exceptions, as the U.S. rules require, in Finland, the burden of proof is on those who would regulate to show that a project meets one of these criteria. And there's a lot of research to be done on how this all works in practice. It simply has not been done to the extent needed. And I think this is, again, a real pity because it could explain what might happen here. Very recently, a former U.S. official warned against imposing any kind of appeals process, warning that revising the regulations to require that every institution provide an appeal mechanism would undermine the IRB's authority and weaken the protection of human subjects. Scary, right? Well, Canada did this, and they did it over 3 years ago. Has anyone in Canada used the appeals mechanism? Has it undermined the authority of research ethics boards? Has it weakened protections for human subjects and participants? I don't know, right? This work simply hasn't been done, but it could be done. And then finally, my fourth question about regulations is, how do they change? How are ethics regimes created and modified? And specifically, what, if anything, is happening right now? In 2011, July of 2011, I was really shocked when the Department of Health and Human Services and the Office of Science and Technology Policy issued an ANPRM, an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, which would be the very first step to a reconsideration of the regulations that we've had since 1981. Now, I had heard extremely vague rumors that something might possibly be being talked about, but the announcement really took me by surprise, and this was the biggest possibility of change in over 30 years, and a lot of people took this seriously. In the 90-day comment period, the federal government received roughly 1,100 comments from individuals and organizations saying how they think the rules could change, and then in 2012, the National Research Council launched a study specifically about social and behavioral research, with funding from the National Science Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Alfred Sloan Foundation, and many others. In January, it issued a 125-page report on that subject with dozens of recommendations. So a lot of people took this seriously. A lot of people think that change might be at hand. And since then, I've heard, again, hardly anything. 1 month, I'll hear that the process is stalled and will never advance to the next stage, which would be a notice of proposed rulemaking. The next month, I meet some people who seem to be connected, and they think that a proposed rule is just around the corner. Certainly, the fact that the human subjects regulations are shared by 18 federal departments and agencies is not going to make change any easier. Is this normal? Right? Is this normal for a set of regulation to remain in place for 30 years and then for a regulatory agency to get everyone really excited and to start spending money from living industrialists and dead industrialists and the whole work and to submit hundreds of comments and then for nothing to happen for a period of years thereafter? Is it normal for a change to require the approval of so many different government agencies? I don't know. You're the political scientists, you tell me. We need this kind of comparative work. Now, Ithiel de Solapool died of cancer in March of 1984, so 30 years ago this month. 2 months after his death, the American Association for Public Opinion Research granted him its award for exceptionally distinguished achievement. Throughout his life, the citation read, he believed in the primacy of free communication, the ability of people to hear, see, to speak, and to read, unhindered by governments of the right, governments of the left, or even governments of bureaucrats. 3 decades later, free communication remains hindered by governments of bureaucrats in the form of ethics review committees and the agencies that require them. How much of that hindrance is appropriate, and how much of it violates our rights? How much of it is motivated by a sincere and informed effort to protect research participants from abuse, and how much from a hunger for power, laziness, ignorance, or simple incompetence? To what degree are bureaucrats, whether at the university or federal level, responsive to the people they serve? These are some of the questions to which Ithiel de Solapool devoted the last years of his life, and the questions that face participants in this symposium. When he reminded his MIT colleagues of the freedoms that we are committed to protect, I think he committed us as well. Thank you.